everyone. This is Roger Gates. Sorry for the delay. You're listening to People's Question Time. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be speaking for maybe 10 minutes or regarding the world's latest news from Melbourne to Washington, etc. Afterwards, I'll invite you listeners to call us on our phone in numbers to speak on what issues I've mentioned and what ones you want to speak about. Well, life has become slightly less complicated, like on the West Bank, where Hamas has paved the way for a unity government, as announced after a deal between Mr. Abbas and the Hamas leader. Naturally, we hope this isn't a false dawn and that the occasional street battles from Gaza to the West Bank are in. And in Guinea, martial law has entered a fourth day, a big after crisis talks. Guinean authorities go into talks with unions amid warnings that the country's current crisis is spiraling out of control because there's a possibility of industrial strikes and due to the deteriorating state of the economy there. And a Rwandan genocide suspect is being denied asylum. The French presidential candidate, hopefuls, Garson and Royal are opposed over the construction of a new aircraft carrier in the French election campaign. A individual matter that I don't think that should bring to an end a campaign to discuss public affairs and issues in France. But there is another one that is more interesting that does enter into a campaign like France's influence in Africa. Decades after independence for her colonies, France doesn't quite want to let go or leverage all of a sudden on the continent, but she can no longer count on the influence and economic privilege she once wielded. And there are tigers in Paris all of a sudden. In Paris, as the town of tigers fight for independence heats up again in the island nation of Sri Lanka. On the other side of the world, in a bustling immigrant neighborhood in Paris, Tamils who fled the fighting find they can never fully escape. I'll expand on this a little since I find this issue interesting. Ransom, a 40-year-old restaurant owner in Paris Tamils quarter, thought he felt left the violence behind in Sri Lanka when he fled his country's civil war in the late 1980s. But he didn't. Now, he says, he lives in fear of the young men who come to his apartment once a week to collect 100 euros for the liberation tigers of Tamil elements lit the rebel group fighting for autonomy for the ethnic Tamils of Sri Lanka. Ramzan says that this has been going on since he opened the restaurant in Paris. I'm basically quoting France 24 story on this. Since moving there in 1990, initially he says, I didn't want to pay the rent, but they hinted that my wife and children in Sri Lanka would suffer the consequences. It sounds like these people are gangsters almost. His wife and children joined him in France in 1995, but Ramstein says that he is still making the payments. He says he tried to put a stop to the payments when his family arrived in France, but was attacked and beaten outside his restaurant. Afraid of calls from the Tigers or their representatives, he no longer answers his phone directly, instead letting it go to the answering machine so callers can identify themselves before he picks up. Now, some say some pay willingly, others don't. In France, many members of the Sri Lankan community especially shop owners and businessmen, say they are being forced to pay contributions for Tamil Tigers to fund their guerrilla war in Sri Lanka. But some of the Tamils pay willingly, eager to support the Tigers' efforts to win broader rights for Tamils from the Sri Lanka government, which both preaches peace but then decides to send reinforcements to the battlefield. And much is dominated by another ethnic group, the Sinhalese. The LIT tells us that the money they are collecting is a loan and that it will be paid back with interest after the war ends in Sri Lanka, says Ashankar, the shop owner in Lashapal, who contributes to the LIT. They are fighting for our rights, he adds. Like many Tamils, Shankar uses only one name. But others say they are obliged to pay because they are threatened or coerced. It's €1 abroad and €1 to pay. According to a March 2006 report by the non-governmental Human Rights Watch, very good group, very notable, most Sri Lankan Tamils living abroad, including Canada, Europe and the United States, are approached and asked to contribute to the LIT. The report says that the fundraisers sometimes identify themselves as representatives of the LIT and sometimes of Tamil charity groups that are widely seen as fronts for LIT. According to Human Rights Watch, Tamils who fail to pay while living abroad are asked to pay double or triple the amount when they return to Sri Lanka to visit. The amount varies but is often circulated on the basis of €1 for each day that each member of the family has lived in a Western society, group says. Once the payment is made, expatriate visitors are given a PIN number and a visitor's pass, which allows them to move about freely in LIT-controlled regions like the Jaffina Peninsula. Aragamai Kamarasai, a 50-year-old Tamil who has been living in Paris since 1987, says he has not been able to visit Sri Lanka in more than a decade. I don't have the means to pay the LIT, he says. Even if I go back to my country, the Tamils will not let me enter Jaffina unless I pay, he says. Adding, even if I had the means, I wouldn't pay because I don't support their goals. Kamasarai says that he is one of the few Tamils who can afford to say no because most of his family is in France. Even former Tigers say they come under pressure. A 45-year-old Mani Sundram says he was a LIT fighter in his 20s but left Sri Lanka in the late 1980s after an internal split within the group. And now the owner of a music store in Paris, I congratulate him, he says he often receives visits from LIT members asking him to contribute large sums of money. They come home, and if I don't answer, they leave a note in my mailbox, and I refuse to contribute because I know my money will be misused, he says. One of the Tamils interviewed for the article gave France 24 a printed slip that he said was pinned to his door while he was out. Yellow slip printed on in the Tamil language reads, "A national freedom worker came to your house, but you were absent. To make it possible for us to get in touch with you, please let us know your day off or the time when you can take a lunch break by calling on the following number." The slip then gives the telephone number, address of the Tamil Coordinating Committee, a Tamil welfare organization based in Paris. So it sounds like the French are now abused with Tamil charity groups asking for money. And the continent of Europe is still a flood of activity. Like in Turkey, seven people have been condemned to life imprisonment. These sentences are being handed down to seven Al-Qaeda associates for their involvement in deadly suicide bombings against Jewish and British targets in Istanbul in 2003. And in Spain, there's another jihadist terror trial. More key suspects deny involvement regarding a trial of 29 people over the blast that killed 191 people in Europe's worst jihadist terror strikes. Moroccan Youssef Belajar and Hassan al-Hafti both insist on their innocence. And Russian President Putin has named a former Chechen rebel as president of Chechnya. However, it seems he's not trying to placate Chechen opinion because he's sort of turned traitor in a manner of speaking. And Human Rights Watch accuses him of many war crimes and human rights abuses. And closer to familiar territory, Russia is now courting the Gulf states. President Putin has wrapped up his first visit to the Middle East in Jordan, and then Saudi Arabia and Qatar this week. Though Russia's influence in the Middle East has waned over the last 15 years or so, Putin is now seeking stronger ties with traditional U.S. allies. And U.S. intelligence agents are to face a trial. An Italian judge ordered on Friday the 26th U.S. intelligence agents and the former head of Italy's military intelligence service to stand trial over the 2003 kidnapping of an Egyptian imam. And the European Union is planning a vote and report on the CIA's network of secret prisons as part of their so-called extraordinary rendition program. In Turkey, during his trip, Israeli Ehud Olmert asked Ankara to send a delegation to Jerusalem in order to take a look at the works being carried out by Israel in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or the Temple Mount, which has caused a storm, no doubt, since it is a significant building in the three main religions in the world. And trouble is still brewing in Lebanon as there is a mass rally remembering the Harari murder. Hundreds of thousands of Lebanese have joined a mass rally in Beirut on Wednesday to mark the killing 2 years ago of former Prime Minister Rafael Harari, with tensions running high after deadly bus bombings. And there is a new security plan in force in Iraq. A traffic jams are blocking the capital now on the first day of the enforcement of the security plan. This has been issued by the Iraqi colonial government. Borders with Syria and Iran have been closed. By May, a large contingent of Iraqi policemen, backed by American soldiers, are going to patrol the country. And in film, there is a close-up on the war in Lebanon of last year. When the war in Lebanon of July 2006 broke out, a group of filmmakers called on their peers to produce pieces about the conflict. And in Africa, Sudan, Chad, and CAR have struck a non-interference deal. There was a slight victory, now speaking regarding Darfur, because the French President Jacques Chirac has urged Sudan to agree to a peace force for Darfur. It's been resilient until the last. Speaking at an Africa-France summit at Cannes, Chirac said that the conflict in the region is a humanitarian catastrophe. In regards to the Asia Pacific, voters have chosen a successor to the late dictator of Turkmenistan. It has held elections to hold a successor to the totalitarian leader, Mr. Yazgov. The poll has kindled hopes of a political thaw, but the trappings of autocracy remain. And in Nepal, there is still a possibility for peace, though the Nepalese king, who's an absolutist king holding on to the last while making occasional concessions, has continued even to now, with U.S. arms and British arms flowing to the absolutist king, a king to make sure that the Maoist rebellion is not repulsed by a Madisi revolt. Talks are now underway between the Prime Minister and representatives of the Madisi movement. and in North Korea has announced it is willing to pursue nuclear disarmament, mostly in return for aid. After many years of grueling negotiations, Pyongyang has agreed to dismantle the backbone of its nuclear program, the Yongbyon reactor, but only in exchange for 1 million tons of oil. And China has pursued a new wave of crackdown on corruption. On today's Asian markets, with some signs of a Japanese economic recovery, a China's crackdown on corruption and its spring festival time in China. This puts no doubt makes China even more attractive for Western businesses, because every businessman wants an equal chance to rob the public, including the Chinese public. And in the Americas, a dispute over gas prices has settled. During a state visit to Brazil, the Bolivian President Evo Morales settled over a year-long dispute with Brazilian counterpart Lula da Silva over gas prices. Brazil agreed yesterday to pay as much as $100 million more per year to Bolivia. And in the U.S., George Bush is defending his Iraq plan as Congress vote looms. And the U.S. President Bush has defended his troop surge plan on the day it takes force, but a Congress vote could scupper the increase. And to be more specific, in his first White House news conference of this year, Bush said a group within the Iranian government was supplying weapons to the Iraqi rebellion. But he said he did not know if top Iranian officials had ordered their activity. So there's a slight U-turn now. They believe Iranians are involved, but they can't prove it. 3 days after anonymous U.S. officials in Baghdad told a roomful of reporters that senior levels of the Iranian government, that's quote, had approved weapons shipments to Iraqi fighters, Bush said he couldn't vouch for it. The U.S. president bristled at suggestions that Washington was fabricating charges of Iranian involvement and stood by charges that the Al-Quds Brigade of Iran's Revolutionary Guard had provided explosives used against U.S. troops in Iraq. He said, I'm quoting, I can say with certainty that the Quds Force, the part of the Iranian government, has provided these sophisticated IEDs that have harmed our troops, he said, referring to impoverished explosives used in roadside bombs, for example. Well, I suggest that he try something else, like withdrawing totally, then those U.S. soldiers wouldn't be subjected to attacks in the first place. Now, listeners, if any of you are interested in calling, you're welcome. The toll-free number, if any of you want to contribute, is 877-876-5227 for the U.S. In Canada, it's 4810-8322, and the direct international number, 530-876-3222. These phone numbers are also featured on the BBS radio website. There is, ladies and gentlemen, surely a case on the refusal to accept pressure from the fanatical and religious not to be silent about the expression of views contrary to what the local mullah says, the local priest says, and in the for the consequences of the publication of cartoons by Denmark cartoonists helps to demonstrate that. Surely one of the many acts necessary is to publicly recognize that medieval tantrums involved in grenade throwing in the process of mass murder in Northern Ireland, for example. Each one from provided by the local church, a mosque and Jehovah Witness, clear-cut, plagiarized versions of each other. They are so stupid that children can demonstrate with the most simplistic of questions how insincere these monotheisms are. I propose that religion should be treated with ridicule, counter-argument, and contempt. This fantasy is gripped with a triad of self-hatred, self-righteousness, and self-pity. I'm talking about militant Islam, as well as militant Christianity, and other copies. Globally, it's a gigantic power, but it doesn't just trouble Northern Ireland residents or Danish residents. It's bumping the ideology of saving others' souls because they are the real sinners, poisoning societies wherever it goes, ruining the minds of our children, training people in violence, in producing a culture of death, suicide, and murder. Here in Australia or Britain, it is an occasional majority with official status, an appalling blasphemy law in Britain to protect you if you offend followers. Literature produced a copy by Islam and every other cult that dares is to be accepted as a divine revelation, and those who reject this revelation are only fit to be treated as cattle. So who is in danger? Those who say, I'd better listen, otherwise I'm in danger. Or me, who says, this is so silly, satires like The Life of Brian, a movie made in the UK, can be made about it. Then up go the placards, up go the yells and howls and screams. Do they get arrested for hate speech? No. Might I get in trouble for saying this? I don't doubt it. If you look around, considering the drivel of exclamations, what about the poor fags, what about the poor Jews, the wretched women who can't take the abuse, the slaves, their descendants, the tribes who didn't make it because their land was forfeit. Look anywhere in any country, including our societies, and beyond, from the war for slavery, the subjection of women as chattel, the burning of witches, the flogging of non-heterosexuals, for ethnic cleansing, or anti-Semitism, you need look no further than a famous book that's on every pulpit, every synagogue, and every mosque. I hope their members will realize, you and I can clearly recognize, that the major source in this country of hatred and violence is religion, of which this country, most Western societies, affords a great deal of protection. While our laws are sometimes used to marginalize critics with censorship, guns and bombs, whether used by a Catholic or Protestant, for example, will go beyond just taking other people's lives, but also their freedom to think and express their thinking without restraint. Pursuing the disarmament from the IRA, something which British are now last doing by addressing the legitimate grievances that there are in Northern Ireland. Well, that, or even the Protestant gangsters, I must say, though Ian Paisley of the DUP in Northern Ireland won't be very happy about that, will not stop the violence and self-righteousness that pervades the UK and other societies. And this is not hyperbolic place for lunacy, as opposed to the Quran, for example. So a man called Muhammad, an illiterate failed businessman, was spoken to by an angel 3 times to be dictated to the final revelation. A nonsense. He never heard such things, and nor will you or I. And it is correct that many societies, religion takes a major role, but it's not like the government of Britain, for example, is going to let British decide on secularism or the maintenance of the Church of England. Now, fear not, ladies and gentlemen. We can all speak contrary to the superstitious tantrums, like many outside the walls of our homes, and continue to do so contrary to the howls for censorship and the second coming of Jesus and Muhammad. And if we are to endorse such treatment, we would all know, we should all know clearly what their views on freedom of speech is. No doubt if a Muslim Briton or US citizen stones a non-heterosexual to death out of just pure intolerance or beats his wife, we will not be the first to condemn such act. And surely it is necessary to provide the counter-argument, not unequivocal endorsement and defense. And we can all believe what we want, but the question comes down to what extent do we enforce it. If someone else isn't of the same faith, does that legitimize mowing down their kids tomorrow morning as they go walk to school? These are questions that should be raised and not swept under the carpet. And we can all stop pretending that we should all be skeptical of towards conspiracy theories, since they're hardly required for humans to achieve their goals. Israel's assault on Lebanon required a conspiracy within the Israeli cabinet and the military, no doubt. Is that worth talking about? No, it's just institutional process, I'm sure. And let us not take false hope in the regular use of the phrase peace process, like in Northern Ireland again, or the Middle East. There isn't a peace process, any more than a Middle East peace process. Rejectionism has been UK policy since Ireland was first invaded, the same as Israel towards the Palestinians since 1948. Recall that Britain's state terrorist campaign in Kenya in the 1950s, where 150,000 Kenyans were killed, was called a peace process. I'm sure if we want one, if you want one, you have my backing and assistance, but the first price will be justice. Now, I welcome you all to the Principles of Enlightenment. May you never say or do anything to reverse the implementation of those principles in any Western society. And I recommend Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's Reforms of Turkey. Is a founding statesman of Turkey and the first prime minister. And we all have a great deal of learning, I'm sure, and not just from publishers of Penguin books. The phrase, believe it or not, that surely we should raise the question, should we have an official faith? That wasn't decided by the people, like in Britain, for example. That was decided by a tyrant called Henry VIII, a self-described king who enforced his rule by the sword without shame. If we can pursue a referendum on the issue. In fact, I dare each of us to pursue referendums on the issue. The effort should help jolt the British Tory Party into reality about what democracy means. It may be a long time since they vetoed against the Great Reform Act of 1832, but these Tories hardly ever change. And devolution in the UK no doubt has helped the issue of reducing the tensions between, say, the English and the Scots. Though now the polls still show increasing desire for Scottish independence, about a quarter of Scots. The vast majority of English want independence for Scots now. There are other things, like secularism, hardly a contentious issue, surely, in a country that featured Enlightenment figures like Thomas Paine, John Stuart Mill, and the like. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, to any of you are listening, if you'd like to contribute, the toll-free number is 877-876, 5227 for the US. For Canada, it's 4810-8322. And the direct international number is 530-876-3222. Or listeners, I hope you haven't lost interest. There is a claim, like on, I'll turn to the Middle East again if I may, regarding Iran's nuclear program, which is regarded as contentious. However, it was snubbed. The US has previously, 3 years ago approximately, had the chance to have a non-nuclear Iran. Iran offered the US a package of concessions in 2003, just before the latest president took the stage, but it was rejected. This according to a former US official who told the BBC's Newsnight program. Tehran proposed ending support for Lebanese and Palestinian militant groups and helping to stabilize Iraq following the US-led invasion. Offers, including making its nuclear program more transparent, were conditional on the US ending hostility. But Dick Cheney, the vice president, said no, according to the official. The offers came in the letter, so it was on paper, it was all laid out. Seen by Newsnight, which was unsigned, but which the US State Department apparently believed to have been approved by the highest authorities in Iran. In return for its concessions, Tehran asked Washington to end its hostility, to end sanctions, and disband the Iranian rebel group, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and repatriate its members. Former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had allowed the rebel group to base itself in Iraq, putting it under U.S. power after the invasion. One of the then Secretary of State, Colin Powell's top aides, told the BBC, the U.S. State Department was keen on the plan, but overruled. We thought it was a very propitious moment to do that, Lawrence Wilkinson told Newsnight. But as soon as it got to the White House, and as soon as it got to the Vice President's office, the old mantra of we don't talk to evil reasserted itself. Observers say the Iranian offer was outlined nearly 4 years ago, corresponds pretty closely to what Washington is demanding from Tehran now. Now, since that time, Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah inflicted significant military losses on the major U.S. ally in the region, Israel, in the 2006 conflict, and is now claiming increased political power in Lebanon. The Palestinian militant group Hamas won power in parliamentary elections a year ago, opening a new chapter of conflict in Gaza and the West Bank. The UN Security Council has imposed sanctions on Iran following its refusal to suspend uranium enrichment. Iran denies U.S. accusations that its nuclear program is designed to produce weapons. And no evidence has been provided that Iran is pursuing WMDs. And let us not forget that the election in Iraq was not free. How can an election in an occupied country be free? I'm going to quote the American conservative of 2006, April 2006, provided a good article to analyze it. Though Bush perennially invoked spreading democracy to justify the invasion of Iraq, suppressing democracy was one of the first orders of business for the U.S. occupation authorities. 3.5 months after the fall of Baghdad, military commanders ordered a halt to local elections and self-rule in provincial cities and towns across Iraq, choosing instead to install their own hand-picked mayors and administrators, many of whom are former Iraqi military leaders, the Washington Post reported, and many Iraqis were outraged to see Saddam's former henchmen placed back in power over their heads. A U.S. viceroy, Paul Bremer, feared that the chaos that followed Saddam's fall would not be conducive to electing positive thinkers. In a post-war situation like this, he said, if you start holding elections, the people who are rejectionists tend to win, and the U.S. military presence would likely be one of the first things freely elected Iraqis would have rejected. The early suppression of popular government helped turn many Iraqis against the U.S. occupation even more. But as Noah Feldman, the Coalition Provisional Authority's law advisor, explained in November 2003, if you move too fast, the wrong people could get elected. The repeated delays of elections were partly the result of the Bush administration's lack of enthusiasm for Iraqi self-rule, as well as its fear that pro-Iran Shiites would win an honest election. The Bush administration only agreed to hold elections after Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the most powerful leader in Iraq, said so, sent his followers into the streets demanding an opportunity to vote. You will recall the elections that were covered even by CNN, for example. After it quickly became clear that pro-American parties will be clobbered, Bush authorized covert aid to Iraqi parties and politicians. However, when senior members of U.S. Congress were briefed on the plan, they vehemently objected, because obviously they were interested in democracy. But Bush canceled the formal plan, then delivered covert aid using back channels and undercover operators, I'm still quoting, that could be kept secret from Congress as well as the American public. Seymour Hersh reported the New York Reporter last July, the White House promulgated a highly classified presidential finding authorizing the CIA to provide money and other support covertly to political candidates in certain countries who, in the administration's view, were seeking to spread democracy. The elections were eventually held on January 30, 2005, and that had more in common with a Soviet Eastern Bloc era election, with a New England town meeting. In the weeks before the vote, the U.S. military carried out Operation Founding Fathers. In Samarra, the get out and vote message was broadcast from loudspeakers. At the same time, American troops, leaping out of Bradley fighting vehicles, raided and searched people's homes. U.S. military convoys rolled through Mosul neighborhoods shortly after sunrise on Election Day, with speakers blaring messages urging everyone to vote, Newsday reported. Soldiers also passed out thousands of sample ballots. Karina Parelli, the top UN official, condemned the role of U.S. troops used in the election campaign. Bush proclaimed on the day of the vote that the elections were a resounding success and that the world is hearing the voice of freedom from the center of the Middle East. The American media largely parroted the official line, but pro-U.S. candidates were crushed at the polls as pro-Iranian parties took the prize. This is defining democracy down. Bush's meddling in foreign elections undercuts his stated principles. James Bullard of the American Conservative in April 24, 2006. So even the U.S. right recognized this. I mean, there are violations, like on the war waged in Afghanistan as well, which we hardly ever hear about. The threat of international terrorism is surely severe. The horrendous events of September 11 had perhaps the most devastating instant human toll on record outside of war. The word instant should not be overlooked, regrettably. Their crime is far from unusual in the annals of violence that falls short of war. The death toll may easily have doubled or more than within a few weeks as miserable Afghans fled to nowhere under the threat of bombing and desperately needed food supplies were disrupted, and there were credible warnings of much worse to come. The cost to Afghan civilians can only be guessed, but we know from the projections on which policy decisions and commentary are based, a matter of utmost significance. As a matter of simple logic in these projections that provide the grounds for any moral evaluation of playing in commentary, for any appeals to just war arguments, and crucially, for any rational assessment of what may lie ahead. even before September 11, 2001, the UN estimated that millions were being sustained barely by international food aid. On September 16, the national press reported that Washington had demanded from Pakistan the elimination of truck convoys that provide much of the food and other supplies to Afghan civilian populations. There was no detectable reaction in the US or Europe to this demand to impose massive starvation. The plain meaning of words. In subsequent weeks, the world's leading newspaper reported that the threat of military strikes forced the removal of international aid workers, crippling the assistance program. Refugees reaching Pakistan after arduous journeys from Afghanistan are describing their desperation and fear at home as the threat of American-led military attacks turns their long-running misery into potential catastrophe. The country was on a lifeline, one evacuated worker reported. And we just cut the line. It's as if a mass grave has been dug behind millions of people. An evacuated emergency officer for Christian Aid informed the press. We can drag them back from it or push them in. We could be looking at millions of deaths. The UN World for Food Program and others were able to resume some food shipments in early October, but were forced to suspend deliveries and their distribution when the bombing began on October 7th, resuming them later at a much lower pace. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees warned that we are facing a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions in Afghanistan, with 7.5 million short of food and at risk of starvation, while aid agencies leveled scathing condemnations of US airdrops that are barely concealed propaganda tools and may cause more harm than benefit, they warn. A very careful reader of the national press would discover the estimate by the UN that 7.5 million Afghans will need food over the winter, 2.5 million more than on September 11, a 50% increase as a result of the threat of bombing, when in actuality that happened. In other words, Western civilization was basing its plans on the assumption that they might lead to the death of 7 million innocent civilians, not Taliban, whatever one thinks the legitimacy of the soaring Taliban recruits and supporters, but their victims. Meanwhile, its leader, on the same day, once again dismissed with contempt offers for negotiation for extradition of the suspected culprit and the request for some credible evidence for this capitulation. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food pleaded with the US to end the bombing that was putting, I'm quoting, the lives of millions of civilians at risk, renewing the appeal of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, who warned of a Rwanda-style catastrophe. Both appeals were rejected, as were those of the major aid relief agencies, and virtually unreported. Now, I'll turn to a much less emotive issue, like Japan's colonial economic model, just in the 1930s, for example, like on the development of Japan's colonies, see, for example, Robert Wade in Governing the Market, Economic Theory and the Role of Government in East Asian Industrialization of Princeton University and Press in 1990. I'm quoting from page 74 to 75. New research suggests that both Taiwan and Korea had higher rates of GDP growth than Japan between 1911 and 1938. Moreover, Taiwan was already, by the end of the 1930s, the biggest trader in the region, though most of the trade was with Japan. Levels of welfare improved. Indeed, some evidence suggests that the welfare of a Taiwanese peasant in the first half of the 20th century may have exceeded that of the Japanese peasant. The scope of primary education expanded so that by 1940, almost 60% of the relevant age group, males and females, were attending primary school. What is unusual about Taiwan's experience and careers is that this process did not give rise to a high concentration of capital and leadership in the hands of Taiwanese elite, because the Japanese kept almost complete control. This delayed the emergence of a dynamic Taiwanese capitalist class, but also contributed to a more equal class and income distribution than in most other developing countries. And then, of course, stopped once the Japanese were driven out of Taiwan and the other countries that conquered in the 1930s and 40s. Though this is not unusual, say, in Western society. There is historical perspective. A book of essays, Cambridge, Harvard University Press, 1962, a classic account of the state role in late development in continental Europe, by Frederick Claymont in Economic Liberalism and Underdevelopment, studies in the disintegration of an idea in New York, New Asia, Publishing House, 1960. On the state's role in the Japanese economy, see, for example, Otoyo Komiya et al., Industrial Policy of Japan, Tokyo Academic Press of 1988. The study by 24 leading Japanese economists concludes that it was radical defiance of prevailing economic theory that set the stage for the Japanese economic miracle. I'm quoting page 15. The actor that played the predominant role in the formation of industrial policy in Japan was the Genkyo, the section of the bureaucracy within the government that had the primary responsibility for developing and supervising policies for a given industry. Then, as now, each industry had one associated Genkyo. The system is rather similar to the organization of the industrial bureaucracy in socialist societies and seems to have no direct counterpart in other advanced Western countries. Overall, MITI, the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry, is the single most important Genkyo ministry within the Japanese government. And Chalmers Johnson, in Their Behavior, Our Policy, National Interest in the Autumn of 1989, page 17 to 25, and page 24 to 25, said, it may well be true that Japan is the most advanced capitalist nation today, but it may equally well prove true, as many foreign observers of the Japanese government, business of the government, relationship have concluded over the years that Japan is the only communist nation that works. See also chapter 2 and footnote 57. On the delusions of the economic profession, see for example Edward Herman's The Institutionalization of Bias in Economics, Media, Culture and Study in July of 1982. Page 275 to 91. This explores the immunity of the doctrines of economic theory to empirical refutation and how the responses of important economic professionals and the publicity given economic findings are correlated with the increased market demand for specific conclusions and particular ideology. Now, there is an economist comment on this, like Paul Barosh, Economics and World History, Myths and Paradoxes, published in 1993 by the Chicago University Press, on page 32 is of note. The Mother Country and the Bastion of Modern Protectionism is one of the book's subheadings. Particularly, he concludes on page 53 to 54, it is difficult to find another case where the facts so contradict the dominant theory that the one concerning the negative impact of protectionism, at least as far as 19th century world economic history is concerned. In all cases, protectionism led to, or at least was concomitant with industrialization and economic liberalism in the 19th century as a major element in explaining the delay of its industrialization. on the results of U.S. protectionism during Europe's experiment with laissez-faire. Paul Barash's economic history map, the world history of myths and paradoxes, is worth a read. To whatever your any listeners are listening, we're just about to run out of time. I thank my colleagues in UBS Radio for broadcasting. I guess I'll continue on a similar note just before the time runs out. There is a case surely to be made that the features of welfare state, like in the US and in the European countries, should not be dismantled given their demonstrated success. We know the consequences, as I mentioned before in the last episode of New York City Hunger. 40% of US children in New York City go to bed hungry every night, obviously contributed by the opposition to US government aid in all its forms. And no doubt economic growth will be considered a factor. Contrary to mythology, financial speculators oppose economic growth. Economic growth is generally opposed by the business community, though politicians may talk about it, including the current one. I suggest you check Lewis Mitchell's Who Rules? It's the Bond Market, Stupid, in the International Herald Tribune, International Herald Tribune of June 13, 1994. I'll quote it. A favour, a weak economy? Who would do that? Enter that mysterious and slightly sinister entity, the bond market, the preeminent force in the economy today. More than any other group, the bond market determines how many Americans will have jobs, whether the job holders will earn enough to afford a house or a car, or whether a factory might have to lay off workers. In sum, the American economy is governed by the bond market, a loose confederation of wealthy Americans, bankers and financiers, money managers and rich foreigners, executives of life insurance companies, presidents of universities and non-profit foundations, retirees and people who once kept their money in passbook savings accounts or under a bed and now buy shares in mutual funds. While some would recoil at being called the enemies of economic growth, the fact is that the Confederation has ruled in recent months that the economy should lose strength, not gain it. The bond market members speak in a monologue, and their message is contract the economy, a U.S. official said. Ms. Clinton's administration does not aggressively challenge the bond market's preference for a subdued economic growth. Keith Bradshaw, a U.S. shift stance in effort to slow economic growth of May 1994, in the New York Times, which he said in an op-ed, after a year and a half of seeking faster economic growth, the Clinton administration has now reluctantly changed course, putting the stability of financial markets ahead of rapid economic expansion. The shift is in keeping with Mr. Clinton's political goal of positioning himself as a Democrat who is not feared on Wall Street. And Antonio Sharpe and Peter John, a sharp decline in the U.S. jobless rate, unsettled bonds in the Financial Times, in June of 1994, in the same year, James C. Cooper and Kathleen Madigan, just what the doctor ordered, slower growth in Business Week of June 1994, page 27, Mark Memot, jobless rate increases, seen as good news, in USA Today, May 8th, 1989, money section. Well, I've heard a beep. I believe that means we're just running out of time, ladies and gentlemen. I bid you a good night and take care.